Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Well, as I said, we're not going to solve this in the remaining, less than half hour that we have left, so I'm not even going to try. Ahmad, why don't you talk a little bit about what it's like to be a Christian in this kind of a context? Obviously religiously a minority, obviously surrounded by two other important monotheistic faiths that whose politics and relationship to each other dominate the region. These Christians are this little voice in the midst of all this. Paint the picture for us of what it's like to be a Christian in the Middle East these days.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's so hard to know where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
But again, these are unprecedented times. But Christians, it's a mixed thing. First of all, Christians are more bold to challenge the peoples of the other faith, majority religion, as to what is your teaching?
Mm-hmm.
Are we in danger? Are we next? Are we going to be swallowed up? But is that your teaching? So it's forcing the other side to deal with their texts and to find an answer to this. So there's more open dialogue about why do you hate us? What's wrong with Christianity? Why do you hate the cross? Why is the cross an offense to you?
Hmm.
Why does Christ's death? Why does this extremist group want to destroy Christians and crosses? And incidentally, a lot of people in the West do not know that the word for crusade in Arabic, crusaders, is literally the cross people.
Hmm.
So the crossers. So every time they mention the crusades, they mean the cross people. That is the Christians.
Right.
And so there's this more open dialogue, open where the Christians are challenging Muslims in that way and asking them what is your teaching. And then it's very interesting that there's been a lot of amazing new attempts by Muslims who see themselves as moderate to try to reinterpret their documents.
Hmm.
And I mean by the documents, the Quran and the Hadith, to try to give it a different perspective. Of course, the problem is that they've got to use a hermeneutic that's convincing, because mm-hmm. it ends up being very allegorical. And
mm-hmm.
So many, uncountless texts are very, very difficult, and they're threatening to the existence of Christians. So there's that issue. But then also we're facing a large number of people from the other faith leaving that faith and into no man's land.
Hmm.
They're just disenchanted, and of course some of them find true faith in the Lord, but there's just this larger group that's a growing group and an unstoppable movement. And politically, Christians side with this other group politically because there's now a bigger voice for democracy, for everybody's right to exist and express their faith. But then there are issues that the church in Jordan in particular is facing. Christians are asking, well, should we bear arms? What if these extremists come in across the border, and they've tried to do that many times? What if they cross the border and they're threatening our cities and our churches? Should we bear arms? That's a tough question,
mm-hmm.
and we're very careful at not answering that question without really studying it. And that's why I wrote to you earlier, Daryl, about just war and mm-hmm. how can we handle this. So we're struggling with this. We had several events at the seminary. We invited political leaders to come, and we've had open dialogues before the Christian and Muslim community about freedom, about openness, about these texts that call for exterminating the other side, and of course we had also to deal with issues like to compare the Canaan conquest with terrorism. How
yeah.
is that different?
Yeah,
and we go into this very deeply to show the difference, and it's been an amazing way to present the gospel and how finally the cross really it really absorbs all wrath forever, and there's nowhere else where wrath is absorbed, and Christ took care of it. So in other words, it's never been so exciting to share the truth than these days. But there's still fear. People are afraid. It's also affected our fundraising. Who wants to support the ministry in the Middle East while it's being destroyed and so forth? Hmm. So these are some issues.
Let me ask you a question that's often raised about the way, and I know if you can't comment, then just let me know. But I've sometimes heard it said that in the Quran there are really two strands of texts because of the history of Islam itself. That initially, it seemed to take an approach that says, well, we will cooperate with the other monotheistic faiths and recognize our common roots. And then as things moved on later, the text became more hostile. Is that a fair way of seeing what became the assemblage in the Quran, that we have these two levels, and that's part of what's producing the confusion even among Islamic theologians about how to work with and read the Quran?
Well, yeah, you've had a very sensitive chord. That's very true. In the earlier days of Muhammad, he was the verses of the Quran. These are his teachings were saying, to be kind to Christians and Jews and so forth. But then later on, that changed when he became stronger. So now, in Islamic theology, it's very taught, there's this very formal doctrine called the doctrine of abrogation, mm-hmm. meaning it's a study of which verses have been abrogated, erased, and replaced by other verses. Hmm. So these verses calling on being kind to the other side are abrogated. They do not apply today. What applies today is these verses that call on all Muslims to spread Islam, and it's geographical. And not to rest until it's spread all over. And that's what scares. So Christians are asking, what is this really true? So and again, this raised recent efforts by Muslim scholars. The latest was last July, 2014. Hmm. Where 126 worldwide scholars wrote a letter to the self-proclaimed Khalifa of ISIS, and went through these several selected texts from the Quran and the Hadith, tried to give them a different interpretation than the interpretation that ISIS is taking. And it's interesting to study this, to see the amazing effort to try to give it a meaning that's really not in the text. Hmm. And that's the difficulty where Islam is finding itself. What do you do with these texts? There's got to be a convincing method of why did you look at them? Making the words carry much more weight than they can carry. Hmm. And that was an allegorical interpretation. And so the other side was not really convinced. But it's interesting, at least, there's an internal struggle within Islam. Yeah. Some people say, Islam has got to be, it's got to be a reformation, kind of like the Protestant Reformation. But few people know that what ISIS is doing, it's really reformation in their perspective. That's going back to their scriptures, just mm-hmm. like the reformers, or the Protestant reformers, went back to the scriptures, only the result is completely the opposite.
Right. Because of this abrogation and the sequencing of these texts?
Right. Hmm. So how can you reform a text? You can reform people, but you mm-hmm. cannot reform a text that's revered as inspired by God, mm-hmm. And this is the very difficult struggle that Islam finds itself. And then with that, when you look at countries like Saudi Arabia that has been, teaching this, proclaiming these texts and these teachings, and now finding itself, it's brought trouble to them, to the country of Saudi Arabia, trying mm-hmm. to protect itself mm-hmm. from the thing they created. And so this is what's going on. And I may have said too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, again, part of what makes this valuable is that there is this internal discussion and debate that I would say many Americans aren't even aware of.
Right.
They just have no clue that these tensions exist within Islam. All you're doing is describing what's there, and part of what makes this such a difficult reality to try and cope with. So let me turn our attention in another direction. We're rapidly running out of time. And it's this. So in the midst of all this chaos that we've described, all the pressure, all the tension, et cetera, what are you trying to say to the students who come to your school about how the gospel speaks into this?
Well, there's so much that can be said. We try to present, if we talk about the difference between Canaan conquest and terrorism, there's just so much to talk about, but it all leads to the cross. And basically, like one convert from a majority religion said, you know, that the extremism tells us to die for God. But the gospel tells us that God died for us, for man. And that, you know, if we're going to talk their language, as that in their mind, the mind of the extremists, it's the deserved judgment of God on Christians or on whoever they consider their enemies. It's that deserved judgment. Well, our answer says, yeah, we all deserve judgment, surely. That's, God is righteous and we've sinned against him. But there's one person that took it for us. You don't have to kill anymore because there's one that took it all for us, and that is Jesus Christ on the cross. He absorbed all judgment. If you believe in him, you're protected from that, what you call the deserved judgment. And so the holy war, the conquest wars were really an expression of God's holiness against sin. But also, it was a message pointing strongly to the cross, where the final judgment comes, and God does not want to judge people; He wants to save people. And so, here lies the very difference in that. In Islam, they don't want to, the idea of a prophet, meaning Jesus, to be humiliated and killed is unacceptable. That's not honoring to Him. It's not acceptable. He should not go through that. Well, that's the very message of it. Had he not been willing to be insulted and beaten, and we would not have salvation. That's the very, very heart of the difference.
So Christianity is very much a countercultural message in your context.
Yes, very, very much so. But it's also an opportunity where it's like whatever is going on right now is given, paving the way for this bright glory of the cross to be shining and giving boldness to Christians to proclaim it, to show the beauty of it. And it's really interesting to discuss this in class and have different students make presentations and imagining that they're talking to the leaders of these extremist groups and presenting the Trinity, presenting the gospel to them, and how, speaking their language and giving them an answer. If they would only just listen, these people are so creative, these students, and watching them express their faith. So these are some of the things. And again, I'm saying a lot here because of lack of time. There's so many issues, but it's really, I'm saying it's an exciting time to communicate the truth of the gospel at this time, this way.
Because what you see in the activity of God is, rather than being a God of wrath, to whom and one to whom a total submission is demanded, and therefore a price is extracted, if I can say it that way. In contrast to that, what we see is a God who's a relational God, a covenant God, not just a sovereign God. And in the midst of that, he offers of himself that which we cannot supply for ourselves as the way out of this trap that we find ourselves in.
That's right. And yeah, exactly. And of course, Muslims believe in Christ. Mm-hmm. They believe in his, amazingly, they believe in his virgin birth, that he did miracles. But it stops right there. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say he's a prophet. Mm-hmm. He did not die on the cross, did not rise from the dead. So we tell Muslims, okay, there's some common understanding about Christ, but the Bible gives us a little bit more, actually much more, mm-hmm. about this person. So we talk their language. What if a head of state would walk into this room? Does that demean him? Does that make him less honorable? Of course not. What if God in his greatness wants to save us and he wants to come down to us? And here's what we have in Christ, in that this person Christ had another nature, that's a divine nature, and he's coming to suffer for us, to save us. So, in other words, it's amazing how new ideas of communication come to present the truth in a way, in a culture that's very much shame and honor culture, mm-hmm. Where it would be more acceptable to see the difference and to quiet their anger. And so forth.
Because the interesting thing that strikes me, now this is studying the majority religion from a distance, is what I see primarily out of the picture of the faith is this picture of this sovereign God, but the relational dimensions of God that we see in the New Testament or in the Old Testament are not there. They're not emphasized. They're not present. God is strictly this. It's almost this ranking that we have to deal with. And so the very idea of God taking on, well, to use the language of Philippians, of emptying himself, of taking on flesh, is a very radical idea in the context of the majority religion, isn't it?
That's at the heart of it. That's it right there. And actually, if you trace it back, you find, okay, because they reject the Trinity, which means they reject a relationship within God. Mm-hmm. So why did God create the world? It's because he lacked a relationship. He only began to have a relationship after creation in their understanding. Mm-hmm. And so God in himself was only a God of will. And whatever he did was by this sheer power of will. Mm-hmm. So every other attribute is a subset of this powerful will. And so even when they say merciful and compassionate, it's not so much that he is that way, but he can be that way, and he can also be the opposite. He can be so many attributes because it's all under this big, powerful will. And again, it stems back from not being relational in himself, not having that eternal love of a father-son relationship in the spirit.
Is there an element of love or grace?
Yes, it's spoken of, but it's a different concept. It's not a father-son relationship. It's more of a master-slave relationship, uh-huh. whereas this master would choose to bestow grace on a slave if he chose to. But it's up to him. And for us to say, there's no assurance here. In other words, for me to say, I'm sure I'm forgiven, it means that I have caused God to act in a certain way on my behalf. That's limiting his power. He's beyond law. He's beyond promise. He's free of all of that, even of his own laws. He's free. You just don't know. That's in their theology, in their teaching. And that, again, stems from rejecting the Trinity, rejecting a relational God. It all translates into this. And it's fascinating to see the struggle in history, in their struggles to understand the attributes of God and how it relates to man. And so it all comes down to this.
Now, are there any, this is such a rare opportunity to be able to ask these kinds of questions. Is there any, are there any covenant structures in the majority religion? Or is everything just a function of creation, creature, sovereignty?
They speak of one covenant of works. In other words, God, in their understanding, had a covenant with the Jews. They broke it, so he had a covenant with the Christians, and they broke it. and part of their breaking it was to declare Jesus as divine, and that he died on the cross, and by doing so they became they broke that covenant. So he put them aside, God put them aside in their understanding, and now it's the Muslims. And again, it's all one covenant of works with all people. You obey, you will, it's that relationship. So the concept of grace in the Christian understanding of undeserved favor is not there in their understanding.
It really is the ultimate supersessionist theology in some ways, isn't it? in which God's favor now rests with this third group that has come along.
Right.
Interesting. We're so short on time. I kind of don't know where to begin. Ahmad, why don't you tell people a little bit about the school and what you do, how it is? If I can use a picture, it's kind of an oasis in the Middle East.
It really is, and we're just full of thanksgiving to the Lord for bringing us to this point. The seminary is 24 years old, and it has not been easy to get it established and recognized by the government, have accreditation of our degrees and programs by international accrediting bodies, European and Asian and so forth. But it's existed there. And we try to reach the 22 Arabic-speaking countries. That's a block of 350 million people. But we cannot get them all because of, obviously visa problems, security issues, and lack of freedom in most of those parts. So we have to work around these. But we're hoping we're experimenting with all kinds of ways to train men and women. And now their number is growing, even from the majority religion coming to faith and screaming for training. So we feel privileged to be in this part of the world at this time to do this. So,
if someone wanted to give to the seminary, how would they do that?
Well, it's easy. We have a website. It's jets.edu. It is a donate button.
jets.edu, right?
Yeah.
That's right. jets.edu. Mm-hmm. And do it quickly.
let me ask you another question that is kind of hovering around the edges here. You've spoken a few times of majority people who have come to faith, and we hear this over here, but don't know kind of what to make of it. That there are a lot of people who are reconsidering their faith commitments as a result of what's going on in the Middle East. Is that going on?
That is true, and it's strong, and it's a big movement that, or in relative terms, it's something that is unstoppable right now. We just wish that they had the opportunities and the freedoms to do what they would like to do. So the next step is for these people to declare their faith more publicly.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of pressure, of course, not to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the first time I really encountered the expression "secret believers" was in a majority religion context, if I can say it that way, and hearing stories about people who wrestle with the consequences of revealing where they really are.
That's right.
Now, how much pressure are you under? And I guess the way I want to ask this is, it strikes me that one of the interesting things about Jordan, at least, is I'm very aware of the site that is located near where John the Baptist is traditionally said to have baptized Jesus, and the almost unusual in an Arab context, cooperation and presence of a Christian site, if I can say it that way, So Jordan is not like some other places in the Middle East. Is that true?
Yeah, it's relatively speaking, Jordan is stable and is welcoming. It's a friendly country, and we're very thankful for it. Of course, it's still a Muslim country. There are limitations, but Jordan is a Christians do exist freely. They have their own church buildings and they worship and so forth. Only it's for people to come from the majority religion publicly is not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, speaking of John the Baptist, baptism, of course, for touristic reasons, the two people on both sides of the river, they each claim that the Baptist did his thing on
yeah,
their side.
Yeah, I've been to that site. That's yeah. one of the most fascinating spots in the world to me. You know.
Well, yeah. Well, we have on the front entrance of Jets a replica of a map from the 6th century, a mosaic map that from the Mount Nebo.
Yes. I've seen that. Yep.
But what's interesting about that map is that it has John the Baptist from the 6th century baptizing on both sides of the Jordan. So we've got it covered.
That's good. Well, they must have anticipated what we were going to need.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, yeah.
You talked a little bit about the favorable environment there in Jordan. What do you attribute that to?
Well, excuse me, that's a good question. Of course, we have a monarchy, of course, and
right.
in some ways that gave Jordan stability because the people are not ready for a democracy of electing and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a tribal society, so the throne gives stability to the country. Secondly, we have a good king. We've had very good kings, and presently King Abdullah and his father, the late King Hussein, who were both wise men that love peace and they're very careful in their decisions, and they're in a very difficult, very extremely difficult situation. You've got the teaching of the majority religion, but then you've got Israel, but then you've got the extremists, and they're trying to please all sides, dealing with refugees coming in. And I think it's really, excuse me, it's got to be the grace of God.
Mm.
And it's just got to be. God has a plan. Of course, eschatologically, we know that in a tribulation, people will run to the east for refuge, and we don't know if that's part of the plan. This is from Daniel 11 mm-hmm. and some of the verses in Revelation. We don't know. I mean, this is, we're just living day to day, thanking God for what we have, but we don't know. So far, so good.
Well, Ahmad, it's been a real pleasure to have you kind of give us a glimpse from within the Middle East, kind of what's going on there. I say this sometimes on podcasts. This time I mean it more than even when I say it another day. We have barely scratched the surface of what's going on and the complexity of what's involved here. But hopefully the conversation has given people a little glimpse of the mix that is making for the situation that we find in the Middle East, and we certainly are encouraged by the presence of Jets and by the ministry that goes on there and by the way in which Arabs are being and Palestinians are being trained to reflect the faith in a context that actually in some ways is like the context the early church came out of, as a distinctly minority faith surrounded by a lot of people who didn't get it and trying to live it out in a way that is as faithful as possible. Mm-hmm. So we thank you for being with us and giving us the time. And Andy, I want to thank you as well for giving us kind of a look at the aspects of the military side of things and kind of how that fits into the mix and give us a little perspective on sensitivities that the military has as it carries out its responsibilities to protect people. It's an interesting mix
that we've tried to
deal with here in this podcast, and hopefully it's been beneficial to our listeners. So I want to thank you for for being a part of it. And thank you for listening to us on The Table, where we discuss issues of God and culture. And we look forward to having you back again with us soon.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Join us next week for part two. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.